welcome, beloved listeners, to Len and Al. And if you thought the Hell's Angels were scary, wait till you meet the Night Wolves, a political force, a very ominous force in Russia. Talking about them soon. Then we're moving on to John Kenneth Galbraith, and we're going to revisit his notion of the affluent society. Canadian-born, Galbraith was a towering figure in American politics, towering, well, to be specific, 6'8", which makes him almost twice as high as his Australian counterpart, Nugget Coombs. We'll be talking about his vision of the future with Mike Berry, because Galbraith got a lot of things right, but with the wisdom of hindsight, he got one thing very, very wrong indeed. And then we're off to the Cocos Keeling Islands, which have a very curious history that very few of us are aware of. Now, there's a mood of defiant nationalism on the rise in Russia, where Putin's annexation of Crimea has proved immensely popular with the masses. As discussed before, this brand of nationalism, aggressively anti-Western, harking back to an older imperialist Russia, has some unusual cheerleaders. They include generals, singers, filmmakers, cosmonauts, and most spectacularly, this group of pro-religion, leather-clad, bearded bikies called the Night Wolves, led by a former doctor known as the Surgeon. You might have glimpsed them riding around Moscow streets with Putin or holding press conferences to declare that they will use violence against any opposition. Is it just theatre, or does it perhaps represent grim normality in the wake of the murder of opposition leader Nemtsov? Now, to try and untangle fantasy from reality, we're joined by journalist Albina Kovalyova, who's covered Ukraine crisis for the BBC and NBC. Albina, welcome to our little program.
Hello, thank you.
Tell us about the Night Wolves. Who are they exactly?
Well, originally they were a biker group. I mean, they started in the 1980s, even before the wall came down, and it was still the Soviet Union. They were basically a kind of anti-Soviet rock force. And then in 1989, they became basically a motorcycle club with their formal name, the Night Wolves, and the Surgeon became the head. But basically, they now have around 5,000 members. They're the biggest bike club in Russia. They existed even before the Kremlin's support, but, you know, in about 2009, the Kremlin contacted them and decided to have a kind of nice photo opportunity with them, with Putin riding around with them. And they became somewhat of a symbol for the new Russia, the new kind of nationalistic flavor of the country.
Now, as you will well, I'm sure you know this, the Hell's Angels did security at a famous Rolling Stones concert, but that's about as radical as they ever got. What radicalized this mob?
Well, I would like to first of all say that they themselves do not say they are a mob. They are in fact very offended by this concept. They say that we're not a gang, we're a club, we're into motorbikes. So they're very, very sensitive about the term mob being referred to them. In terms of radicalization, that's another issue, I think, you know, whether you can say they're radical or not. I mean, nationalism in Russia, whether, you know, it's radical or not is a big question. But certainly they have always been pro-Russia. They have always identified with the Russian spirit. And in recent years, they've become more nationalistic, saying, you know, we are for the traditional values of Russia and the family, and have basically turned their back against the Western values. Although what is interesting is that they still ride Harley Davidson motorbikes, so it's a bit of an irony there.
Yeah, but they are now, well, perhaps they've always been intensely homophobic, and so there has been a shift. Were they always involved with religiosity?
No, I'm not aware that they were always involved with religiosity. The surgeon actually recounts a moment where he encountered a priest who turned him towards religion. So that was a kind of personal moment for him. But I think it also ties in with the Russian religious movement, which the Orthodox tradition, which has been reinstated really and has grown stronger in recent years and has really flown into this mood of nationalism, and also exists as a sort of antidote to the Western values like homosexuality, like sort of multicultural diversity in that sense. So I think the Russian state is very much tapping into the Orthodox tradition as something to reinstate what is Russian about Russia.
When I was introducing you, Albina, I mentioned the fact that they talk up violence. Do they commit it, or is it mainly theatricals?
Well, there is certainly no known evidence to say that they have committed any anti-Western violence or any violence, apart from perhaps some sort of brawls between different biker groups. But certainly I'm not in a position to say that they've been involved in that either. Their positioning is fierce. They have a very fierce image of don't mess with us. But that is a tough image of the country as well. I don't know if they have been involved in any violence or if it is just show.
Yeah,
but I think that's part of the problem in Russia at the moment. The image and the reality is very blurred. It's the same story with the Ukraine crisis. You know, it started when the conflict first began in Ukraine. There was a lot of media propaganda. It was very image-based. A lot of the sort of images of violence when we were there on the ground didn't add up to the reality. They were it looked like they were fabricated by the media. So in this sense, I think the Night Wolves anti-Maidan, which is a movement they've created recently to fight the sort of pro-democratic movement of Russia, is another sort of media message. I'm not sure that there is actual violence behind it, but it's unclear.
Well, given that Rootin Tootin Boot Scootin Putin loves to get his shirt off and wrestle bears, he must be very drawn to this group.
Well, indeed. I mean, the Kremlin contacted them originally in order to sort of to create this photo opportunity for Putin. And since then, they've been riding around quite a lot together. They fit in pretty well into the sort of picture, I think, that the Kremlin is trying to draw of Putin and of Russia and the toughness and the muscle sort of flexing. Because these guys, I'm sure if you've seen pictures, they look pretty tough and scary.
I'm fascinated by the Harley-Davidson connection. For heaven's sake, Russia has had a long history of building pretty rugged motorbikes.
That's right. Well, that is something that I think next time I meet the surgeon, I will ask him why exactly he rides the American bikes, even though, you know, there are plenty of Japanese or Chinese or Russian bikes he could be riding.
Have you interviewed the surgeon?
Yes, I have. I've recently actually interviewed him for ABC News.
Okay, tell us about him. What's it like up close and personal?
Up close and personal, he is like a big teddy bear. He's very friendly. He's very media friendly. He's all smiles, but the rhetoric is very unnerving. You know, he still talks about the enemy, the fifth column, who are pro-democratic. So it's a very mixed feeling. You know, when you meet him, he's quite a charming man.
You talk about the shows put on by the Wolves. What kind of shows? Tell us about these extraordinary choreographic events that occur.
They are rather extraordinary. Last summer, in August, they staged a massive show with fireworks, pyrotechnics, and incredibly well choreographed. It was something on the scale of the kind of Olympic ceremonies that Russia was staging when the Olympics were on. It was really something amazing with you know, dozens of very well choreographed dancers, people on motorbikes, smoke, But at the same time, the message of them is frightening. You know, it is all about, this show in particular in August, was about how Ukraine was overrun with fascists, the West was, the evil West was sort of supporting them, and the rebels, and this is, mind you, in August, this is at the height of the conflict where when the violence was escalating, you know, the rebels were portrayed as saviors of the Ukrainian people who were caught up in this conflict and really glorified.
Another undercurrent in the Soviet, well, a major current, was, of course, anti-Semitism. Are the wolves anti-Semitic?
I'm not aware that they are particularly anti-Semitic. I think they're really, it's all about Russia and the greatness of Russia. It's not about finding enemies within initially. That's, you know, what it became with this anti-Maidan movement. But even, I have to say, with the anti-Maidan movement, which they founded in January, and the messages there were very strong and it was very aggressive, you know, sending a warning to the Russian opposition. Since the murder of Nemtsov, they have toned down that sort of rhetoric and that threat. So I think it may be that the Kremlin has said to them, look, now is the time to tone it down. I think the Nemtsov murder has been a big shock for the whole country, and it's not something that Putin finds acceptable and useful to him.
I used to visit the Soviet in the bad old days, and while, yes, the people hated the regime, they were also very proud of the fact that the Soviet Union was a superpower. And I remember thinking at the time when this evaporated, that this was, in a sense, a form of emasculation for so many in the population. And the health of men, I remember, deteriorated very dramatically. You know, the life expectancy for men in the Soviet, well, in Russia, in the post-Soviet, deteriorated almost overnight. So in a way, this need to be hyper-masculine, which is, you know, displayed by Rutan Tutin Putin and the wolves, is explicable.
Yes, I would agree with that. But of course, I think the decline in the health of the population, in the general sort of well-being, had to do with the poverty that came after the fall of the Soviet Union. And of course, the democratic beginnings under Yeltsin are really remembered with great anger and distraught by a lot of Russian people who were absolutely, absolutely poor and desperate. And Putin's economic growth and stability has actually helped a lot of people become much more better off, much more able to travel and, you know, buy cars and generally have a much more kind of middle class kind of life.
Including, if you wish, Harley Davidsons. Now, okay, what, for every action there's meant to be an equal reaction, but there doesn't seem to be a surge of liberalism and must be just too damn dangerous.
Well, if you mean by liberalism going out into the streets and protesting the democratic rights or having fair elections or being very serious investigative journalists in Russia, and even, you know, just having businesses that might have conflicts with either the government or the security services or someone who's connected to them, then yes. But I think it's still possible in Russia to have a fairly free life. There is always this kind of schizophrenic feeling that, oh, all our rights are going to disappear and it's going to be impossible. And there is a lot of laws that are being introduced that, you know, really make it difficult for people to continue to live freely. But at the same time, so far, you can live more or less like in any European country until it affects you, like in the case of Nemtsov.
How did you find you were treated when you were wandering around the place asking difficult questions? Were you threatened in any way?
In Russia, I have never had any issues at all. I am Russian. I speak with a clear Moscow accent. Perhaps that helps. I mean, of course, I represent foreign media, but most people understand the role of foreign media. I think as a journalist, it's never been particularly difficult for me. What is interesting is how in society now things are changing, and people now sometimes accuse me of being, of representing sort of Western values and the evil West who is out to destroy Russia. Now that happens not professionally, but just on a personal level where people know that I'm working for a foreign news organization.
Albina, thank you very much for your time. Albina Kovalyova, journalist and producer working for The Beeb. This is Len and Elle. Up next, we revisit Galbraith's affluent society 50-plus years later. You know, thinking back over the decades here, I am often astonished at the remarkable people, the great figures we've managed to attract to the program. No one more distinguished, really, than John Kenneth Galbraith. He used to come on quite often. He was always very approachable. We could give him a ring, and so we wanted to discuss this or that with him. And I remember on one occasion he walked out of a dinner party and found a quiet corner of the house and talked to us for 20 minutes. This relationship culminated in what I mentioned before, a visit to the Galbraith Mansion. Oh, I think it was in about 1999, and there it was, a rather gloomy place in the grounds of Harvard. And when I arrived, he was leaving in an ambulance. So the day didn't start well, but one of his sons became very distinguished in his own right, said, "Don't panic, he'll be back." And an hour or so later, back he came, got out of the ambulance, the whole 6'8" of him, and we then had the most marvellous afternoon. Now, yes, we talked a lot about economics, and we talked about his role in influencing American policy, his relationships with umpteen US presidents, but what I will always remember is that he carried a torch for Jackie, literally carried a torch. What he wanted to do most of all was to take me around the gloomy house, shining his torch on photographs of he and Jackie, and there were a great many of them around the place. I don't know what Mrs. Galbraith thought, but there they were, thither and yon, as well, of course, as the predictable photographs of him with her late husband. Delightful, distinguished, extraordinary fella. And, of course, one of the great intellectuals of the 20th century. Let's just listen to a few words from Galbraith from that particular interview.
We must not measure human achievement by economic production, by the gross national product. It is not a high gross national product in that time, which, when spring comes as we talk, and people head out of the United States for Italy, for Florence. It was not their high gross national product that attracted them. And let us bear in mind that William Shakespeare was a product of a country with a very low gross national product or a gross domestic product. Let us realize that there are achievements, very great achievements, that are outside of the field of economics.
Now, you've got to love an economist who says things like that, don't you? One of his books that he was most proud of was, yes, The Affluent Society, published in 1958. And it was on the top of the US bestseller list for over 6 months, frequently revised. But we're not here to talk about a revised edition of his bestseller, but to talk about a revisited one. Mike Berry has written The Affluent Society Revisited, taking the points raised by Galbraith and applying them to today's world in light of the global financial crisis. Mike is Professor of Urban Studies and Public Policy at RMIT. He's also a frequent advisor to state and federal governments in Australia and was Foundation Executive Director of the Australian Housing and Urban Research Institute. Michael, welcome to Len and Elle from your home in Victoria.
Hi, Philip. Thank you.
I have to add, Galbraith went on to say that there would be a time when economists would retire into a useful role such as dentists. That doesn't seem to have happened.
No, indeed. Exactly the opposite. They seem to be right out in front, telling governments and everybody else what they should be doing.
Can you outline for the listener who may not be across Galbraith's main theories why he thought economists would one day disappear?
Well, he argued that economics as traditionally practiced, and it's indeed still practiced, was an economics of scarcity, that we lived in a society where basically we all had to keep our nose to the grindstone most of the time, and that was the only way to survive. He argued instead that at least by the mid-50s, the advanced nations, particularly the US, had got to a stage of affluence or economic development where more and more people would have more and more time to develop, you know, the better, higher quality of life that he looked to. So in that sense, he was repeating very much what one of his teachers, not literally, but intellectually, Lord Keynes, had said 20 years before. He was really arguing that affluence rather than scarcity was going to be the defining feature of societies like the US and Australia and Britain and so on.
Why did he get it so wrong? I suppose everyone at the time had a similar degree of confidence in an improving future.
Indeed, I think the 1950s was really the high point of post-war optimism. To some extent, it's been somewhat downhill since then, particularly over the last 30 or 40 years. But in his case, there were all sorts of promising signs. I mean, from about the 1930s, we had seen a significant decrease in economic inequality, a situation of high economic growth in the post-war period. A lot of the gains from that growth was being distributed down the income spectrum, a growing middle class. He argued that basically, you know, a rising tide would lift all boats, that the problem of scarcity was gradually being worked out of the system, and that the figures were there to demonstrate that. He also argued there are a whole series of institutional factors working in that direction. We had a strong government, we had governments involved in so-called mixed economy, getting involved, regulating, seeing that those fruits of economic growth were fairly evenly distributed. So he was really arguing that there were all sorts of countervailing forces to the traditional unequalizing forces of the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer.
It's almost a kindness, Mike, that he's no longer around, because by the 80s the process had was, you know, one truly in reverse. Look at the situation now with the famous 1%.
Well, he recognized that already by the early 80s, and although he didn't substantially revise his book, he wrote a number of other books which talked about the culture of contentment and the unequalizing effects. He realized that he, in retrospect, had underestimated the extent and the power of those who did very well out of the system to do even better. And he was, for a time in his own mind, at least a socialist rather than a liberal. And he really was, I think, quite pessimistic towards the end of his life.
Like Donald Horne, he was being ironic. I mean, Don's The Lucky Country was a bit of an intellectual joke. Was that, to some extent, so was the affluent society?
I don't think so. I think he really did believe that governments that listened to wise economists such as himself, people who are in the real world rather than the ivory tower, could really engineer an increasingly affluent and fair and just society. And he spent a lot of time, as you indicated in your introduction, in getting involved in real world politics. He really was public intellectual number one for the Democratic Party. And he was, until he fell out badly with Johnson over Vietnam, very much in the White House for up to 10 years. He was also Adlai Stevenson's key economic advisor.
Yes, and that's where there's a parallel, of course, with Nugget Coombs, who had the same sort of durability. Yes. Incidentally, I remember asking him whether he knew anything about Nugget. He'd never even heard of him. I didn't have the heart to tell Nugget that. Okay. He was a Canadian, of course. How did he get involved so deeply in US politics?
Yeah, he was actually a backwoods Canadian. He grew up in a small Scottish you know, a farming community. And he got very interested, I think. He went as an undergraduate to an agricultural college. And somehow he ended up at Berkeley in one of the premier economics departments doing his PhD. I still haven't quite worked out how he got there, but he did. And obviously he was a brilliant student. And he was lucky, I think, and he had a number of quite influential patrons in the academic world. They eventually got him to Harvard, and Harvard was quite close to Washington. And being a sort of a doer, he very quickly found the quick plane trip from Boston to Washington. He went there very early in the New Deal period, and was back and forth to Washington over the next 30 years.
And of course his towering physicality made him immensely noticeable. In the Paradox, it was Nugget's tininess which made him noticeable.
Yes, obviously it doesn't pay to be average.
Yeah. Okay, now the whole GFC thing sort of happens a couple of years after his death, but as you suggest, he would have seen this as a case of history repeating itself as both tragedy and farce.
Yes, he was extremely contemptuous of the monetary policy authorities. He really thought that central bankers were a mystical cult unto themselves, and that monetary policy was an extremely blunt instrument to use. And it was used primarily because it was congenial to the wealthy and the powerful.
Which brings us to the reason why you've written the book now, Mike. It's not on the 50th anniversary of its publication, which was in 2008, but writing it later gives you the chance to place Galbraith's work in the context of the GFC. How does his work help to understand it?
Well, I think he was perhaps the first economist that I know of to really argue that the coming problem in the affluent society was going to be one of inflation. And when the 70s developed, the inflationary spiral that we came to see, he was very much seen to be a prophet of this. But the problem was, not only did inflation come in the 70s, but so too did unemployment. And that ran against the sort of Keynesian underpinning that lay beneath the institutionalist approach he took to economics. So not only were the conventional economists bamboozled, but in a sense, so were people coming from the Keynesian side as well. And I think the other really prescient point that he made back in the 50s was the increasingly problematic nature of debt. And that I think, is the critical factor that we can look at the global financial crisis, because quite clearly debt ran away in all sorts of ways that he couldn't have seen. Nobody could have foreseen in the 1950s, but he was, I think, wise enough to know that a society based on increasing spirals of debt was going to be inherently unstable. And again, in this he was repeating some of the earlier comments and thoughts of John Maynard Keynes.
Keynes still survives. There are still people who, including myself, who see him as a hero. But Keynes isn't too popular in the upper echelons in the United States.
No, partly because, of course, so much of what his analysis suggests, when properly decoded, is quite relevant and quite accurate. And I think it was in the 1970s that President Nixon said, "We're all Keynesians now," and then very quickly after, "We're all not Keynesians now." But since the global financial crisis, there have been books published like The Revenge of Keynes and The Return of the Master and those sorts of comments. And I think Keynes would have been critically in favour of that. But as I say before, he was someone who really focused on the institutional basis of economic and political power and the relationship between economics and politics. And I think in a way that made Keynes's analysis somewhat naive politically. He really did, Galbraith really did believe that the economics practiced in the academy then and now was a cover for the interests of the rich and powerful.
My guest is Mike Berry, Professor of Urban Studies and Public Policy at RMIT University, and he's a Foundation Executive Director of the Australian Housing and Urban Research Institute, and this, of course, is Len Nunnell. Neoliberalism has taken reducing inequality off the agenda, Mike, but you note that we were fortunate in that aspects of the welfare state were so embedded prior to the rise of neoliberalism, unlike the US.
Yes, I mean, we were lucky in all sorts of ways, and it's one of the reasons why Australia escaped relatively unharmed from the direct fallout from the global financial crisis. I think the critical question for us is, will we remain lucky in the non-ironic sense going forward, given that so much of our prosperity has depended on our exports and our external relations, and very much has depended on the rise of China in our region? And I think that that question is still very much an open one.
You're right, of course, that ideology and political power matter in understanding how America's affluent society has developed over the past 50 years. But that doesn't provide a lot of hope, of course, as we move through this century.
No, I think you mentioned Ken Galbraith's son, James Galbraith. He's just written a book called The End of Normal, which basically says that the 3% trend line of growth in the 50s and 60s that his father was used to has really gone the way of the dodo, that we're really looking at a new normal situation where growth is going to be much closer to 1% than 3%. And if that's the case, some of the prognostications of economists like Thomas Piketty come into play, that we may see increasing levels of economic inequality back to levels that we haven't seen since the beginning of the 20th century.
Well, Piketty must be one of the economists who's been influenced by Galbraith, as indeed you have.
Yeah, I think it's hard to say what the cross-Atlantic connections are. I think you'd find a French economist would argue that they've developed all this on their own.
Well, the thing you and I must discuss off air is we need to get a biker gang, I think, to like the Night Wolves, to help push social change in Australia. Okay, the greatest attribute to the affluent society, which you remind us, are the failings of orthodox economics, and I quote you, "The economy is not a machine, but a complex system embedded in social layers of complexity." How can we better understand this system?
Well, I think there are a number of very useful approaches, some of which I mention in the book, relating to what are called heterodox rather than orthodox approaches to the economy and economic development. And Galbraith was really a sort of pioneer in one of those areas. But what we're starting to see is a lot more emphasis on what used to be called political economy, which was in a sense changed to economics or economic science in the post-war period. So we're going back to questions about how political power, economic power, and social and cultural factors all interact and reinforce each other in a sort of dynamic non-equilibrium situation. And I think that's really the underlying lesson that comes from Galbraith's work.
Mike, thank you very much for that. Mike Berry, Professor of Urban Studies and Public Policy at RMIT, with specialties in housing, urban planning, environmental policy and political economy. And his book, The Affluent Society Revisited, is published by Oxford University Press. And I suspect the interview, that final interview I did with Galbraith, is part of the In Bed with Philip archive. I'll check on that, and if so, I recommend that you listen to it in its totality, although, as I admitted earlier, things we discussed before and after the interview were even more intriguing. Late Night Live on LRN, and we're off to the Cocos Keeling Islands. Now, the Cocos-Keeling Islands, Australian territory, situated halfway between Western Australia and Sri Lanka in the Indian Ocean, and perhaps some of you have been there for a tranquil holiday. If so, please let me know about it. But did you know that the islands were first settled at pretty much the same time as the British were establishing the Swan River Colony in 1829 with the towns at Fremantle and Perth? Or that there's a big community of Cocos Malays living in Australia as there are still living on the islands? And the history behind all this is absolutely intriguing. And to tell us about it, I welcome John Mateer to the program. John is an author, poet, curator, joins me now in our Perth TARDIS. John, welcome to our Little Wireless program.
Hi, hello, Philip. It's great to be here.
The Quiet Slave is the name of both your book and also a project you've developed for a Perth-based international art event. Tell us about it. Or tell us about the event first.
Yeah, let me tell you about the event. Unfortunately, the main exhibition of it just finished a week ago, but I believe it will tour regional Australia next year for 2 years. Mine was one project of a number, about 15, and it began when I visited a community in the town of Katanning, which is about 150 kilometres south of Perth, southeast of Perth. And I discovered that a substantial part of that farming community were actually Malay people. And these art projects are all concerned with investigating communities that are in remote or rural Western Australia. But I thought this was a very interesting community because they were a community very consolidated who identified as Cocos Malay people, yet were actually living on the Australian mainland now for what's now about two generations. And when I started talking with people about this, I realised that there was this very interesting story about how they came to be on the Cocos Islands themselves. And so I thought that should be the main focus of my project, even though I was working with them in this rural community and then later with the people on the islands themselves.
Now, the first Malays are believed to have arrived and settled in the islands in, the 1820s,
yes,
when they were brought as slaves and as members of a harem by an English adventurer.
Yes, well, that's a conventional account, and that's what you read in almost all the books about Cocos Islands. But as I started to investigate, I realised that there were several presumptions in that needed to be unpacked, as they say. One was that they were slaves. Now, when they arrived on the islands, this was actually slightly after the end of slavery within the British Empire. But slavery was actually dismantled in two ways. The first was to make buying and selling slaves illegal, and then sometime later, owning slaves was made illegal. So obviously people who had slaves had this predicament of what to do with them because they were essentially assets and they didn't want to give them away. But obviously that's what was implied by these two acts. And what I found is people in various parts of the empire were dealing with that by moving around. Often they were sailing from what was called the East Indies, and sailing back to England and offloading their people at ports on the way, sometimes in Sumatra where there were illegal slave ports, sometimes in Cape Town where they could sell them as indentured servants, and then the Afrikaner people who hadn't yet left the Cape might buy them as slaves. So what seemed to have occurred is Alexander Hare had this group of people who were in his household and didn't really know what to do with them and thought that he might go back to Java at some point in the future. And it seemed, and I can't confirm this, but it seemed that the people were on the island in a sense in a kind of a holding pattern, waiting for him to make a decision about whether he might go back to Java and take up his properties and take them back as labourers.
Is it true that there was a wide variety of origins of these people, that they came from, you know, from Bali, Timor, Sumatra, Batavia, etc.?
Yeah, well, essentially the group of slaves he had were from his household in Malacca. And Malacca, up until the end of slavery, was actually a central point for the trade of slaves, as was Batavia. But of course, Batavia was the Dutch centre, and Malacca wasn't really a slaving port under the British, but it had all the cosmopolitan qualities of slaving ports. And he had lived there for some years, and had actually, in many cases, been given slaves by sultans from other parts of what's now Indonesia or Malaysia as gifts, which was a common practice. And so a certain number of his household were actually gifts, and it's hard to ascertain which people might actually have been purchased. But essentially, the conditions that they lived under there were not the kind of slave conditions that you imagine watching American movies, very severe conditions. They were more or less household servants. And the things that were said about Hare were partly true, in that it seemed that he was interested in many women, having many women in his household. But part of what was said about Hare seems to have actually been propaganda put forward by the Dutch after the British left Java and Sumatra, when Napoleon was defeated and the Dutch got their territories back. And Hare had actually been caught up in a political transaction that the Dutch were using as propaganda. That's not to forgive Hare what he did. I mean, I think he was questionable in a whole series of ways, but maybe not as obviously or explicitly as he said.
Well, let's move on from Hare. Bring Clooney's Ross into the story. How does this happen?
Yes, again, there's various misconceptions about this, principally put forward by the Clooney's Ross family, I think. But it's what occurred when Alexander Hare sailed from Cape Town with his group of slaves that he had tried to offload, and he arrived at the Cocos Islands. He declared repeatedly that he didn't intend to live there. He didn't intend to make a settlement there. But what he intended to do, we're not quite clear, but he certainly declared that. And Clooney's Ross, the first John Clooney's Ross, who it seems had made some kind of an agreement with Hare, who had been his employer, to actually settle on the islands, arrives slightly after Hare and says to Hare, well, I actually want to turn these islands into a port. You must decide what you want to do, because really you can't just stay here occupying all the islands. And he was occupying almost all of the islands when Clooney's Ross arrived. And what transpired, which is really the subject of my book, was a kind of a competition between these two figures for possession of the islands. And ultimately what occurred was Clooney's Ross, through various strategies, got the slaves on his side. And Alexander Hare, who seemed to have been on the verge of going a little bit mad, actually, towards the end of it, leaves the islands in 1830. And the Clooney's Ross family stay on the islands until the 1980s. In fact, some members of their family still live there. But principally, they left when the islands were taken back by Australia.
Let's not rush that, because mm-hmm. I remember these events quite clearly.
Oh, good.
But how did Clooney's Ross treat, well, the slaves, the servants left behind?
Yeah, well, this is a very interesting question, and sort of related to why I started to investigate this. Because when I began, I was interviewing people in the town of Katanning, asking them about their memories of being on the islands. And one thing that struck me was, even though it was clear that they had been exploited, and they had never been paid in cash, they had never been paid in Australian dollars or even in British pounds or any other currency, they had a kind of a fondness for the Clooney's Ross family. And this is something I sort of recognise from certain colonial countries where people have big households and the servants within the household are to some extent seen as family, both by the people running the household, but also by themselves.
You make it sound like offcuts from Gone with the Wind.
I have to say, when you're there, you think it could make a mini series of that kind. It's really quite a strange place with a large manor house and a kind of a feudal cultural logic.
You talk about the Clooney's Ross and Hare going at it, you know, fighting for supremacy. Was the fighting physical or just manipulation?
No, well, what occurred, I mean, one part of it is that Clooney's Alexander Hare was behaving quite irrationally. And when I visited the islands, what really struck me was the fact that he was said to have built a house and kept the female slaves and their children on this island called Pulu Bras, which means rice island. But that island is only, I don't know, maybe not more than 20 metres round. And even if it had eroded a lot or whatever, it didn't actually make sense for anyone to set up there. So I kept looking at it thinking, oh, this is like something out of an early Werner Herzog film, you know, this mad person on this little island.
Werner would love this story. For heaven's sake, don't tell him.
Don't tell him. I could see that there was something going on there in terms of his own irrationality. But Clunies Ross was determined to make something of the island, which Hare wasn't. And so Clunies Ross was considering setting it up as some kind of a port where they could supply passing ships. And also the principal export was copra. And he set up a trade in copra. Early on, he started that process. But he realized, because he only went with European British settlers, a very small number, he realized he needed labor. And he actually couldn't convince any settlers to come to settle those islands. And so he very much needed the Malay people to work for him. And as one reads the documents, you can see he's sort of progressively realizing it's going to be impossible to live there until he can get these other people on side.
And did you do so through kindness or coercion or both?
Well, I think Hare was so unkind. He just had to be the fair party. And I think a lot has been said against the Clunies Ross family. But actually, to understand the circumstance they were in and that the Malay people were in, one needs to see how the Malay people were thinking of their own circumstance. And that's what I was writing about in this book, because when you observe certain of the things that the Clunies Ross family did. For instance, one of the John Clunies Rosses always walked around with a knife in his belt. Now, this wasn't to scare the people.
That was much photographed and caused offence here in Australia at the time.
Yes, but actually what seems to me symbolic about that was he was carrying the knife as if it was a Malay kris, like a sacred sword, which encapsulates the spiritual power of a leader of a Malay community, usually a sultan. And there's various other strategies that they did, like I think it was on Sundays he would sit on the wharf. This is much later on than I wrote about, but the John Clunies Ross of the 70s would sit on the wharf, and people who had committed misdemeanors would come and kind of confess to him. Now, the cultural logic of that is very peculiar. It's not really a Western cultural logic. It's a Malay cultural logic. And I think there was a sort of a dovetailing of a kind of a feudal conception of settlement, which the Clunies Ross family had, and the Malay idea of fitting in with a kind of a patriarchy.
Let me ask you this. To what extent did the Clunies Ross people Christianize the other citizens of the community?
Pretty much not at all. Yeah.
They were allowed to keep their animist or their older beliefs.
Well, again, this was something that interested me a lot because of course, when you look at Indonesia or Malaysia, people were animist in various ways, and then Islam came in various waves to metropolitan centres usually. And so I had a sense that probably the first people on the island didn't conceive of themselves as Muslim or weren't very familiar with Islam, even if they did consider themselves Muslim sort of vis-a-vis the Christian Westerners. And at various points in the history, they've become more Islamic, more Muslim. But I mean, that doesn't mean that there aren't animist qualities within their Islam as well.
Okay, well, that's just as there's animist qualities within the Hinduism in Bali.
Yes, of course. Yes.
It's, you know, it's so profound. Okay, very briefly, why did the Clunies Ross get the flick?
Well, there were various moves against them. One of which isn't very well written about in the historical accounts was actually the Malay people themselves were realizing that the Clunies Ross family were not good for them, and this happened in various stages. I think most dramatically after the Second World War, when a large number of the population were forcibly sent to Borneo because of overpopulation. And then in the 1950s, the father of the Imam of Katanning was actually one of the leaders who complained about Clooney's Ross to the Australian government. But it kind of unfolded in stages until there were petitions made at the United Nations. And then I think that was the point at which the Australian government was realised that they really had to do something about this this strange circumstance, you know, of Queen Victoria granting the islands to her family.
Yeah, quite extraordinary. So tell us now about the Cocos Malay residents becoming integrated with Australia and this large community you discovered or write about living in Katanning.
Yeah, well, my book's about the early days, actually, on the island principally. But the community in Katanning, I think, is in the range of several hundred people. And there's also a smaller community in Bunbury and also in Port Hedland. And then there's also a group of Cocos Malays, actually, who are living in Borneo now, which I've not investigated at all. But apparently there's several villages of them in Borneo. But they very much see themselves as Australians, although they are very religious. And the older people all speak Malay, the younger people not so much. But it's Islam that I think consolidates them as much as the sense of being this particular very small ethnicity.
John, what do they know about their origins and history?
Well, There's a misunderstanding, which was the source of my research about what happened between Alexander Hare and Clooney's Ross. Principally, it's believed that Clooney's Ross, believed by the Malay people, that the Clooney's Ross family actually took them to the islands. And you see, what's important to me about understanding the nature of the beginnings of the island is that I'm interested in how those people came to be there from the various parts of what was called the Malay archipelago, how it is that people from Borneo or people from Java or people from Malacca ended up on the island and how they became essentially this new, really modern ethnicity. Cocos Malay exists nowhere else except in those islands, and actually, it's an ethnicity that parallels the founding of certainly of Western Australia. It's a little bit later than Sydney, for instance, but actually, they become a group of people, not exactly from the beginning, but more or less from about the 1860s, when the difference between the original slaves and the slaves that were brought from the Java starts to break down, and then they all start to call themselves Cocos Malays.
John, I've got to wind us up. Thank you very much for your time. John Mateer's book, The Quiet Slave, it's being launched next Monday in Canberra. John will be in Sydney following that to give a series of talks, and we'll put the details on our website. Well, that's it from Lynn Earl for the week. Let me thank the team. Thank you, Kate McDonald, Christine Short, and Ruther Slee, Matt O'Neill, Joe Wallace, Caitlin Furlong here in Musselbrook, and the boss, Gail Basario. Have a great weekend. See you next week.